I want to introduce to you all for this autumn a new lectionary. Lectionary is a fancy word for the series of readings that get assigned for each Sunday. When we follow the lectionary, it's called the New Revised Standard Lectionary. No, it's not. It's called the New, what's it called? The New Ecumenical, the Lectionary, RCL, Revised Common Lectionary. There we go. And this is an ecumenical lectionary with a three-year cycle that goes through chunks of the Hebrew Scriptures, a psalm, chunk of the Gospels, and a chunk of the Epistles. They tend to be really short, often disjointed, and you get a chunk from all the books of the Bible, but it tends to be in fits and starts because there's no, the pieces are all too short to be a narrative. And we have the Bible because it is narrative. It is stories that people remembered and shared and eventually wrote down. And so then this new lectionary called the Narrative Lectionary lets the stories be a little more complete. They're not always the entire story, but they're longer readings. And during the fall, we're going to be doing primarily the Hebrew Scriptures. So you can see the narrative of God's acting in the world from creation through the prophets, the period of the kings, period of the conquering of the land, the time of slavery, Exodus. We'll move through that time as a narrative through the fall. Come Advent, we'll be looking at the story of Jesus' birth and all that opened eyes and hearts to that happening. And then in the spring, we'll be doing longer narratives in the Gospels. I hope this works for you. We'll try it for the first time today. Because it's narrative, it's story, and I hope you can hear it not as,
we are now going to be reading from the Scriptures, blah, blah, blah,
but rather, here's a story, And it's a really good one. And the one we're starting out with is not the first creation story from Genesis, but kind of a second, third creation story, or recreation story, the Noah story, Noah and the flood. And so your insert has the piece I'm going to be reading, but if you can hear well enough, it might be well just to listen rather than read along. Next week I might get a rocking chair up here, so it's a little bit more proper. From Genesis 6, the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings that I have created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God, and Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw that the earth was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Now I am going to destroy them along with the earth. Make yourself an ark. That is the biggest order in the shortest amount of words I've ever heard. I've been trying to build a kayak for 3 years, and it's still just a frame. Make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you are to make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its width, 50 cubits. And its height, 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above. And put the door of the ark in its side and make it with lower, second, and third decks. For my part, I am going to bring a flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your wives, sons' wives with you, and of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds, according to their kind, and of the animals, according to their kinds, of every creeping thing of the ground, according to its kind, two of every kind shall come into you to keep them alive. Also take with you every kind of food that is eaten, and store it up, and it shall serve as food for you and for them. Noah did this. Again, three words for a really major honking job. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him at the end of 40 days. Now, this is one place I'm not sure about the lectionary here. They kind of skipped the actual flood part, and now it is 40 days later. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent out the raven. And it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent out the dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set its foot, and it returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put his hand and took it and brought it into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark, and the dove came back to him in the evening. And there in its beak was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent out the dove, and it did not return to him anymore. Then God said to Noah and to his sons and daughters with him, "As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the domestic animals, and every animal of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy earth." God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." We have a short reading from the gospel, also about some waters being troubled, a windstorm on the Sea of Galilee.
"A windstorm arose on the sea, so great that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him up, saying, 'Lord, save us, we are perishing.' And he said to them, 'Why are you afraid, you of little faith?' Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a dead calm. They were amazed, saying, 'What sort of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?'"
Thank you. Our culture really doesn't know what to do with the story of Noah and the Ark, or Noah and the Flood, or however we entitle it. Mostly we use the story for cute children's books or baby room wallpaper. We had that. Because there are animals, right? Cute and fuzzy animals on the wallpaper and in the books. There's always two lions and two giraffes. two kind of generic monkeys, two elephants. You never see a monitor lizard or a tsetse fly or vampire bats or leeches, tarantulas. Never in children's books are there watercolor paintings of the pairs of each of the 1.5 million species of beetle out there, the 75,000 species of parasitic worm, 10,000 bird species, over 10,000 reptile species, a total of over 6.6 million land species of animal. I'm assuming the 2.2 million different species living in the ocean could probably take care of themselves during the flood. Which brings us to the other way our culture reads the Noah story. A part of our culture reads the story like it's a science textbook. Well-funded fundamentalist groups like Answers in Genesis create entire amusement park museums to show how a literal, even scientific, reading of the Noah story is possible. Down in Kentucky, where they were actually able to get this to be tax exempt, they've made a full-scale ark in Kentucky, 510 feet long, which is what happens when you turn 310 cubits into feet. It's the largest timber frame structure in the world, but it needs to be supported with concrete and steel. And if there actually were a flood, it would sink like a stone. It even has baby dinosaurs aboard, which is because I always thought the dinosaurs and the unicorns missed the ark, and that's why we don't have them anymore. But my Bible teacher had a different theory. Every multi-billion year geological and biological phenomenon on Earth, every aspect of scientific consensus on Earth science, on evolution, and astrophysics is explained by simply saying, the flood did that. And the case is closed, and we have to go on. No answers in Genesis, as far as I know, as to where that water went. It's a giant drain in the ocean, I'm not sure. But a large portion of our culture reads Genesis like it is a science textbook, and that's what we teach our kids. Another way our culture reads Genesis is to go wildly the other direction, and I guess if my seminary had any flaws, this was it, to bring a hyper-academic literary critique to it. And so you compare and contrast the Noah stories, there are actually two Noah stories in the Bible from the so-called priestly source and the Yahwist source, and they wove those two stories together. If the story we had sounded a little repetitive, like God was angry at the earth twice, that's because those are two different stories kind of chunked together. So we don't only do that, but we also compare it to ancient Akkadian texts, the ancient Gilgamesh epic, where petulant gods, upset with how noisy humans were, sent a global flood. And it was our hero Utnapishtim, sometimes called the Babylonian Noah, who was warned by the goddess Enki, also builds an ark, also sealed with bitumen and pitch, and also collects animals and food. And at the end of the flood, releases a raven. And he and his wife and children are the only survivors. Utnapishtim is later elevated to godhood by the god Enlil. So you can go that way also, and you basically drain all the blood from the story by simply looking at its literary aspects, and the story itself kind of disappears. Some scientists say that are looking for archaeological and geological evidence, not for a global flood, because there isn't evidence for that, but they're exploring around the Black Sea, which used to be, about 12,000 years ago, was a freshwater lake, separated from the Mediterranean by a fairly thin band of land. And as the last ice age ended and the seas rose, that band of land was overcome right around 5000 BC with the force of 200 Niagara Falls, devastating and flooding thousands of square miles of agricultural lands and villages in a matter of weeks. It would have indeed seemed like a global flood, but their entire world was devastated. There's no consensus on that. I hope we get more news about it as their exploration's happening. So, you know, there's all these different ways that you can read the story of Noah and the flood. You can read it as a children's book. You can read it as a science textbook. You can read it as an allegory. You can read it as just another ancient Near Eastern flood narrative. None of those satisfy, for me anyway. How do we read the Noah story in the 21st century? I think we're supposed to read it as a morality tale and as a prophetic warning about how humans are living on the planet and how we're supposed to care for creation today. I read from the insert today the extended chunks, some extended chunks from the Noah story, but I left in one, I think, key paragraph for how we interpret this text for today, and that is in the regular bulletin part of your bulletin. And I left an important Hebrew word in there. Now, it's pronounced in a way that may make you blush, but the word is translated usually as pollution, or in the New RSV, in that third or third paragraph, as corrupt. And this is that same paragraph. And I'm putting it in here because there's an important twist. Now, the earth was full of shachat in God's sight. And the earth was filled with violence. And God saw that the earth was full of shachat, for all flesh had acted like shachat upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Now I am going to shachat them along with the earth. Now he wasn't just doing that to be high school level cute with a word that sounds like what it is. It's because in the English translation, that last use of the word shechat, it doesn't get translated as corruption, it gets translated punish. It says, God says, I'm going to punish the earth. But it's the same verb, or the verb form of the same words, the same root word, shachat, as was used in the rest of the paragraph. The way we usually read it when shachat is translated two different ways, as both corruption or corrupt and then as punish when God does it, is that it sounds like humans did X and Y, so God punishes them with Z. But if you read it in the Hebrew, it's rather humans did X and Y, so God let X and Y be their punishment. Do you see the difference? It's not that God said, oh, you're doing this, so I'm going to give you a crazy, wacky punishment that has nothing to do with this. It has everything to do with it. It's what in a child's development they call natural consequences, right? Natural consequences. Humans were doing corruption that was causing the earth violence, and God let it happen. There were consequences. God allowed shachat to destroy it all. That's an important piece when we talk about the nature of God. The problem I always had reading that is that God seems a bit overreacting and capricious. As bad as the Babylonian gods who are upset that human beings were partying too loud, so they destroyed the earth. But God's saying, you guys are doing really bad, so I'm going to wipe it all out. And not just the humans that are doing the corrupting, but every living land creature. God didn't so much destroy the corruption of the earth as let its consequences happen. I think that's point one of this reading. How do we interpret that now in 2018? I think we get clues to that in the Bible itself. Jesus in Luke 17 refers to the days of Noah. And he says this, they were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed all of them. If you read the whole Noah story, you hear people being warned and warned and warned, and they keep doing life as usual. Jesus doesn't mention any evil stuff, just that everyone was passive. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage. They were just doing their regular stuff, what people do, even while they were being warned. Even as they were living in a way that corrupted themselves and the earth, its violence against creation and against themselves, and folks went merrily along as though nothing was wrong, despite the warnings of someone who knew that something was up. And what is up in 2018? What is the shachat that human beings are creating with every activity they do? Carbon. Carbon dioxide. Which is leading to climate change. Which ironically is going to lead to flooding. Global flooding. 97% of climate scientists agree that the Earth is warming and most of the change is human caused. Anthropogenic is the fancy word. And yet, like in the days of Noah when Jesus said it, we sit back and we drive and we burn coal because the problem seems so big and intractable that we feel there's nothing we can do. So we do nothing. I drove down to Methuen day before yesterday. I did, seven? Almost 8 hours of driving for a two-hour meeting. And I don't know how many hundreds of pounds of carbon I let out into the earth. To be able to do a review of annual conference, which we certainly could have done by Skype. But we live like we do normally, even though these are not normal times. We do nothing. There's an old saying that has been attributed to Mark Twain, like all old sayings are, and I found out just last night that he didn't actually say it. It was attributed to Dudley Warner, who said, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." The reality is almost the opposite. Everybody is doing something about the climate, and nobody's talking about it. At least politicians aren't talking about it. And news networks aren't talking about it. And industrialists certainly aren't talking about it. And in fact, over the last 2 years, we've been going backwards on it. The Noah story, with a lone voice warning of impending flood, is precisely the situation today. The shachat of carbon in the atmosphere has gone from 275 parts per million in the year 1600, to 350 parts per million in 1986, to 410 today. It is raising global average temperatures dramatically. It is making drought worse and flood worse. Colder colds and warmer warms. And the rapid melting of glaciers and polar ice caps is raising the sea level. It's not a future thing anymore. It is raising the sea level. And in the next century, those levels will rise catastrophically. Depending on the most optimistic computer model is 3 feet. The more realistic ones, they say, are 15 feet. Yet we feel helpless. So here's point two. The Earth needs to be handled with care. This fragile gift of God's creation to us needs to be handled with care, and we have not done a very good job. and it's time to step up. One NASA scientist said that back in 1986, individuals switching to LED light bulbs and electric cars and solar panels on their homes could have made all the difference and halted the greenhouse effect where it was, about 1 degree of rise. And we blew it. We blew that chance. We blew that time. And now it requires an international effort to move immediately to 100% renewable energy, keeping the rest of the carbon in the ground and divesting from oil and coal industry stocks. That's not individual stuff anymore. That means you have to start making a difference in the real world. And as much as I detest the word, it means politics. Not partisan politics. This is not a red-blue thing. This is a green thing. It means being vocal, it means being informed, it means voting for folk who say that our grandchildren's lives are more important than the billion-dollar CEO salaries for today, and your great-grandchildren's lives and your great-great-grandchildren's lives. Do they count more than a CEO making another $100 million a year? Does it mean buying products that make a smaller carbon footprint than another product that you can get 10% cheaper? It means being informed, it means being vocal, it means getting active, and it probably means if you have any land investments in southern Florida or Bangladesh or the Maldives, you might want to sell them. Point three from scriptures today, I think, is that everything in our lives needs to be handled with care. The earth, other people, ourselves, our relationships. And we have a hint of how to do this from the Jewish tradition. At sunset tonight begins Rosh Hashanah, the birthday of the world, and Yom Kippur, the Jewish holy day of atonement and repentance. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writes, "On Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and the days between, we enact one of Judaism's most powerful yet unfashionable beliefs, that our lives individually and collectively have a moral dimension, that we are the good we do in the world, and we are accountable for the bad we did or the good we failed to do. That is decidedly unfashionable in our world, where the only thing we're supposed to look out for is me." And I'd appreciate it if you all would just look after me. That would be good. Thank you. God does not ask us to be perfect, Sacks says. God asks us to try our best to love God, to love our neighbor, and to love the stranger. Love all of creation. And when we fail, as we all do one way or another, God asks us to acknowledge our failures, to fix them as we can, and try again. I think that is our fourth point, is that God helps us. God longs to help us heal the earth. Rabbi Sacks didn't mention that term, and I've told you a bunch of times about that we are called to be tikkun olam, healers of the earth. Tikkun olam. God has placed people before us who are there to help heal, and for us too, be in the process of healing with them, healing bodies, minds, and relationships. And the symbol for that in our story from Noah, and one we need to hold on to, is that symbol of the bow in the clouds, as the Hebrew puts it, but the rainbow. That is the promise of the sign of the covenant with all creation that God makes in the Noah story. The rainbow is a reminder to us and to God that we are all in covenant with the created order. Human beings with human beings with creation, human beings with God. We're called to be in right relationship. This community lives that out. Y'all are going to be marching for Cole and all his fellow survivors and those who are ill. You're helping a couple with their mortgage while they are sick with cancer. We are feeding folk. We are teaching English and citizens classes. What? I'm looking out here at all the things, all the volunteerism, all the helping that I hear these amazing stories with. You are teaching. You are volunteering. You are helping. You are loving. You are befriending. You are holding hands in hospital rooms. You are visiting when people are lonely. You're bringing connection. You're bringing covenant. After my wife's head injury, and we're going on, I think this is her 15th anniversary since her brain injury. It was awful. We also found it an amazing time of people being there for us. And an incredible time of work, hard work for Barb and for the whole family. And the term that was used, and I hated it at the time, was Barb and you and the kids are simply going to have to learn a new normal. I hated that term. Because I didn't like the new normal. We weren't even to the new normal yet. I liked the old normal. I liked my old Barb. I liked our old family dynamic. I liked that a lot. It was comfortable and wonderful and great. But gravity happens, and rocks happen, and ocean happens, and we had to deal with that reality. About as concrete as it gets. So we have a new normal. And our new normal is better than 99% of people who suffer injuries like that. So I'm eternally thankful for it and for the people who were there. But it was an opportunity to come to a new balance that worked. It's not the balance we would have chosen, but it's the new balance that we were dealt. The place our planet is right now is going to find a new normal. And where that new normal ends up depends on us working with God to be tikkun olam, healers of a world that is literally going to be drowning in shachat and flood. So you moral agents, you healers, you lovers, have the most important calling we can have. Tikkun olam, brothers and sisters, on this Rosh Hashanah, be healers, be lovers, be God's people. Amen.